on Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs will come to order. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for being here. We have three bills that we'll be having hearings on today, and we will start with House Bill 2313, and the staff will read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2313 makes technical corrections to the statutes relating to vehicle dealer franchise. Thank you.
Okay, and we'll call Ted Reutlinger, who's our legislative counsel, forward. Good morning, Ted.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2313 is brought to you by the Legislative Council Committee. The only intent of this bill is to make technical changes to the franchise laws. It's not intended to make any substantive change to those laws. These are technical corrections that we discover when we edit the Oregon Revised Statutes after the session is over. What Section 1 of the bill does is amend 651.20. That's the definitional section for the franchise laws relating to motor vehicle dealerships. All this change does is take out the word franchise and substitute the words franchisee's business, which, if you look at the definition there in subsection 5, makes it consistent with the rest of the section and avoids the situation where you're defining a term with the word that you're actually defining. So that's all we're intending to do there in Section 1. Section 2 is also in the Motor Vehicle Dealerships Law, and that section governs the authority of a franchisee to prevent the establishment of an additional franchise near the franchisee's franchise. The first three subsections refer to new, relocated, and replacement franchises, but the remainder of the section only refers to new and relocated franchises. So we just fix that by taking out the word new and substituting the phrase additional or replacement so that the entire section is consistent with every other subsection. Finally, in Section 3 of the bill, the only thing that's happening there is we are correcting a citation to federal law. Down in the very last line, you can see there's a reference to Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act, but the reference to the United States Code section was incorrect. And that's all that's happening in this bill. Again, it's just a technical fix-it bill.
Thank you. Ted, can I ask you in Section 2, subsection 6, you mentioned the relocated words being on there. I guess I missed exactly why that's the only section that has relocated.
Madam Chair, the reason that they're all three added there is that in the original language you can see it just referred to new. However, we believe that the intent of the section was for this attorney fee section to apply to all of the actions under this section. And under this section, you can take somebody to court to pursue an injunction to prevent the establishment of an additional franchise, a replacement franchise, or a relocated franchise. So we just changed those words so they would cover all of the possible civil actions under the section.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Call Daryl Fuller of the Auto Dealers. Morning, Daryl.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Daryl Fuller. I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, which is the association representing franchise new car dealers. I did not prepare any testimony this morning, written testimony this morning, but I did want to indicate that we are in support of the bill. I also want to acknowledge and appreciate the strong showing from the Oregon School Employees Association, who are here on behalf of the bill today, to demonstrate their strong support of the franchise system. Thank you very much. Teams of lawyers representing both the manufacturers and the dealers and consumers have gone over this bill with a fine-tooth comb, and I want to let you know that we agree wholeheartedly with the Legislative Council. The bill does absolutely nothing. And so with that in mind, we're strongly in favor of the bill, And this is a great opportunity for Republicans and Democrats to come together in a bipartisan fashion and say we accomplished nothing today. So with that, I encourage you to pass the bill. And if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Questions? We will say nothing.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Darren. That concludes the testimony on this bill. And we do have a work session on it, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2313, open a work session on House Bill 2313. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would make a motion that we accept House Bill 2313, move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts has moved House Bill 2313 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Madam Chair,
Senator
Gerard. I would move 2313 to the consent calendar.
Okay. Representative Gerard moves House Bill 2313 to the floor, adding it to the consent calendar. Is there discussion? Okay. Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Murphy?
Aye.
Representative Joplin?
Aye.
Representative Kitts?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair
Quillen? Both aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2313 moves to the floor. Thank you very much. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 353 and call forward Dave Barrows and Andrea
Joya.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Barrows. I'm here today representing Complementary Health Care Insurance. With me is the president of Complementary Health Care Insurance, Andrea Joya. We have before you a bill that has come over from the Senate. It has a timeliness factor, and we appreciate very much, Madam Chair, your bringing this bill forward to help with the timeliness issue. Ms. Joya will explain very briefly what the bill does, and if I may, I might make a concluding comment or two.
Morning.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing us today. Senate Bill 353 lowers the capital reserve requirements for health care service contractors that furnish only complementary health care services. It requires that complementary health care services maintain reserve requirements that are equal to those maintained by dental services and optometric services rather than full healthcare service contractors. Currently, complementary healthcare service contractors are required to maintain capital reserve requirements equal to traditional healthcare plans. Complementary healthcare service contractors incur much less liability in the policies that they issue because the policy limits do resemble those of dental or vision plans. Therefore, it is logical to require that they maintain capital reserve requirements at the lower rates as well as lower surety bonds. Any questions?
Representative Gerard.
Yes, ma'am. Good morning. Would this also help to reduce liability insurance?
Absolutely. It would help us to reduce the cost of surety bonds because the surety bonds decrease from $250,000 to $50,000. And as you well know, the surety bond market right now is quite tight.
If I may, Madam Chair, just another word or two. We worked for about a year with the insurance division on this bill and have come to closure with them. They are in... they don't support the bill or oppose the bill. They're fine with the bill and they're fine with the language, and we have also showed the bill to the representatives of various health insurance companies here in the building, and they all have no problem with it. And as I'm sure the Megan's analysis showed you, there was no objection in the Senate side, and it just rolled through there. And I don't believe anybody has been signed up in opposition today.
Okay.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Paul Steve Kafori.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, excuse me. My name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here in speaking favor of the bill on behalf of two of my clients, the Oregon Remodeler, excuse me, Oregon Acupuncture Association. I got too many going right now. Oregon Acupuncture Association and the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. The Oregon Acupuncture Association is in favor of the bill, of course, because we're listed here as one of the health care services, complementary health care services. We've spent some time looking at this bill and talking with the sponsors. My two clients do have one concern, but we think those concerns have been resolved. The issue is that complementary health care services includes massage therapy, and we would ordinarily be upset about defining that practice as a health care service. However, we have a couple of things in the bill that give us reassurance on that issue. First is that this definition only pertains to ORS 750.005 to 750.095, which has to do with insurance code. It does not increase the scope of practice of massage therapists. Secondly, in the definition of health care services, you'll notice on line 25, it talks about services that occur whether or not contingent upon sickness or personal injury. It's our contention that massage therapy is a service that is for people who are neither sick nor have had personal injuries. And the third thing gives us reassurance is that we've talked to people who are proposing to provide this service, and they're telling us that whenever a service will be provided by a massage therapist, they will be referred first by a practitioner who has the training and experience and scope of practice to do evaluation and diagnosis of the problem, if there's any. Those are my comments, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cafori. And can you just direct me in the bill where it talks about referred by a practitioner? Is it implied in the statute?
Madam Chair, it's not in the bill, but as I understand it, this bill is directed towards one single company, and that company plans to do exactly that.
Okay.
And it's our contention that if that were not the case, that the massage therapist would be operating outside their scope of practice, and since that's not going to be the case here, we have no concern with the bill.
Okay. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, that concludes the testimony on Senate Bill 353. I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 353. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would move that we move Senate Bill 353 to the chair or to the floor. Excuse me, with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts has moved Senate Bill 353 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Motion carries. Senate Bill 353 moves to the floor. Representative Rosenbaum, would you carry this bill?
Sure.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 353. And, okay. We're going to stand at ease for a moment while we're waiting for Representative Cruz, who's chairing in the next room. We'll have to give him time to get here, so we will stand at ease. Read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the Committee, House Bill 2762 requires a public body to conduct collective bargaining in public. It requires that the public body notify the public of this collective bargaining and authorize the resident of the public body's jurisdiction to bring civil action for violation. Application of this act authorizes the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission to penalize public officials for violating the act and allows a maximum civil penalty of $1,000. Thank you.
Welcome, Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Jeff Cruz, State Representative, District 7. Thank you for accommodating me. I'm actually right next door in the middle of a work session in my committee, and so I'll make this very, very brief. The bill's rather self-explanatory, I think. The concept behind this is really relatively simple, and I'm sure it's non-controversial, is the fact that when we're dealing with public funds, the public ought to be privy to what is going on in the discussions about the allocation of those public funds. So because we are dealing with dollars coming from the people, I think it's appropriate that the public have access to the negotiations that determine how those funds are allocated. It's very simple. That's about it. I'll answer any questions.
Questions for Representative Cruz? Representative Rosenberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Representative. I honestly have not looked at this bill until just now, so bear with me if this question is off the track. But it looks to me like the definition of collective bargaining here would include not just negotiating contracts, but also any meetings that are applying a collective bargaining agreement or interpreting, and it seems like that would apply to grievance meetings or any meeting where you just wanted to discuss what contract language meant without being in a formal setting at all. Is that your intent in that language?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, no, not to go that far. I mean, grievance is a whole other issue, and we need to have some confidentiality in some aspects of this. I was more referring to the front-end negotiations that arrive at contracts.
Representative Cruz, can I ask, do you know if there's any other states that have this particular process?
Chair Close, no, I don't, but Oregon's always been an innovator.
Representative Shelf.
Thank you. Thank you for coming, Representative. You know, I frequently hear this drumbeat of how government should be run more like a business. There's not one business in America that publicly discusses contracts with private unions, purchase of property, material, anything like that that could possibly have an impact on their business. And there's a whole long list of reasons why government does things in private. When I was on Echo Valley City Council, we discussed purchase of property, evaluation of employees, the hiring of employees, the evaluation or discussion of the performance of elected officials, appointed volunteers, any number of things. And I think we're just opening a can of worms with this, and I don't think I'm going to be able to support it. That's not a reflection on you, Representative. I just think, I went back to my original point, we're going to run it like a business. This isn't how to do it.
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, yeah, government should be run more like a business where it's appropriate, but government is a different type of business, and I would say that if there's a private sector business that derives its revenue from tax dollars, that they should be under the same standard. But keep in mind that what we're talking about here is a distribution of tax dollars, money taken from the people of the state of Oregon, and how it is allocated and spent. I just think it's appropriate that we try to do some things in this state to connect the people to the process of government, and try to do things that get them to a level of understanding of how we operate and the reasons behind what we do. That's not saying that these contract negotiations are inherently flawed. It's what it's saying is that I think it makes good sense from a public policy perspective for the people of the state to understand the process of how we arrive at the points we arrive at.
Representative Gerard.
As a former county commissioner and as a member of the news media for almost 40 years, I applaud the bill. There's nothing that should be, the public should be prevented from seeing other than a personal or confidential matter when we're dealing with taxpayer dollars. So I think it's a good bill, and I will support it.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Gard, I would like to maybe address some of Representative Rosenbaum's concerns that this may be a little bit far-reaching as far as intent, because clearly there are some things, personnel matters and other things that need to happen that confidentiality is an important factor. So I would be interested in looking to see if we need to make amendments to make sure that where we're going is on point and doesn't have unintended consequences.
Representative Kitts.
Representative Cruz, thanks for coming today. My question is this, as it relates to meetings conducted by the government, what is your bill aiming to do more specifically that, like, let's say, for example, the Sunshine Laws don't currently cover? And I guess when it comes to confidentiality, I think that, you know, my concern, you know, on the front, on the surface, is that things we all know get taken care of in sometimes in better fashion when it is behind closed doors, when it's in the, you know, not in the public's direct interest, because I think that if it's in the public's direct interest, that it's covered by the Sunshine Laws that currently exist. So if you could just address that.
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, I guess that's the exact point of this, is that I think it's in the public's best interest to know these things. Currently, the negotiations are between the unions and the executive branch, and not even legislators necessarily are privy to what goes on in those negotiations. We just see the end product, and it's been problematic a time or two in my term in the House of Representatives that were kind of put in a box as far as budgets by the negotiations that take place. But more than that, it gets back to the fundamental right of the people of Oregon to understand the processes that we go through to make determinations on how we spend tax dollars.
Thank you.
Representative Gallegos and then Merkley.
Since you're in the hot seat, let me ask you, there's been a lot of attention in the press lately about the open caucus meetings.
Yes.
And the desire of a lot of folks to try to make those open. What would you say is the difference then between this type of open bargaining session and the open caucus meetings?
Well, I would say the main difference is that, and I think it's, you're pointing specifically at Republican House caucus meetings because they're not open, but what we are having in those meetings are general discussions about issues coming before the legislature. What we are talking about here is an actual decision process. The decision process in the House of Representatives still happens in committees and on the floor. There's never a vote taken in caucus and we pass a law. So I mean, it's one step removed from this, what we're getting at here.
Thank you. Representative Merkley.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Would this openness extend to deliberations leading to the putting a position on the table?
My sense of what I was trying to get at, Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, was I wanted the deliberations when we have the union and the executive branch both sitting at the table. Now, clearly, for either side to be working on their position, that wasn't where I wanted to go. In other words, when the union's team that is developing what they're going to offer, they should have the right to do that with a level of privacy. It's when we get down to the actual offer made, offer accepted sort of thing that needs to be in the public.
Thank you very much, Representative Cruz. We will let you go back to your committee.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, and I'll call Jim Bastuanas. Bastuanas, excuse me. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Bastuanas. I'm the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. I don't have any written testimony for you this morning. I found out about this bill from our lobbyist very late last night, so I reviewed it and make some comments on the bill and what I heard Representative Cruz comment to. We are opposed to the bill. I'm not opposed to it because it allows the public to come into a bargaining session. a portion of this statute, 192.660, in fact, already allows for that to happen, for the public to come in and watch bargaining sessions as they go on. Anybody that wants to come into our bargaining sessions and wants to watch them is certainly more than welcome to do that, whether it's the public or the media. We don't have anything to hide in our process. However, this bill, to us, goes beyond just opening this bargaining to the public. It appears to me, in reading a number of these statutes or a number of these subsections of this bill, that it puts a bigger tax burden on the taxpayers, and it puts a bigger expense on the agencies, governmental agencies that are bargaining, because it mandates certain things be done. For example, they must provide an interpreter. They must provide a place for somebody to listen if a bargaining session is done on a telephone or by some forms of electronic means. That costs money to be able to do that, money that we now do not pay. Further, it requires that the bargaining be held at the administrative headquarters of the public body. In our case, that means fourth floor of the public service building. That is not a very convenient place for anybody to have to go to. Currently, and we have for the last three bargaining sessions held our bargaining sessions at our association office in our conference room. The last three times we have recorded our bargaining sessions, we set up a machine and we leave it set up for the duration. Obviously, we don't have paid parking issues out there. We have ample parking. It's just kind of disconcerting to me that we're going to take a process and require now that public agencies spend taxpayer dollars to ensure that the public gets invited to these meetings. Like I said, I don't care if they're there or not. The statute already allows for that to happen, for them to be there. We talk about the expenditure that we want to keep the public informed on taxpayer dollars. And I have to tell you, to be honest with you, it makes an implication that public employees don't pay any taxes. I paid enough taxes last year to pay my salary for a month. So we pay taxes just like every other Oregonian does. And if we're going to open this up publicly, then why don't we open it up all the way? Open it in the private sector as well. What they bargain and what they get at the table ultimately impacts what I or anybody else in this room will pay at the store someplace because of what that bargaining session was. So should I not have a right to know what they're bargaining? Should I not be able to go to their bargaining sessions and learn what they are doing? I would say that I have just as much right to learn what they're doing and what it's going to impact me out of my pocket as the public has to learn what it's going to impact them and their taxpayer dollars. Also, I'd like to refer you to ORS 243-656, which is a policy statement that the Legislative Assembly put together on bargaining. There are 5 points there. The first one just reads that the people of the state have a fundamental interest in the development of harmonies and cooperative relationships between government and its employees. And number 4 says the state has a basic obligation to protect the public by attempting to assure the orderly and uninterrupted operations and functions of government. There's some other pieces in there to talk about what we're bargaining over and why we're doing it, but I don't see where this bill helps any of that, quite frankly. Thank you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Jim. I guess I'll ask you about 192.660. You said, and I've read it, it says it already allows the public to enter in. Is the stipulation made in there that that only applies to the the negotiations until, is it closed door meeting after that?
Subsection 2 of that reads, labor negotiations shall be conducted in open meetings unless both sides of the negotiators request that negotiations be conducted in executive session, and labor negotiations conducted in executive session are not subject to the notification requirements of ORS 192.640.
So in the bargaining that you do, both sides have to agree to go to executive session?
We have to agree to go to executive session. For us, in our bargaining process, we use what's called interest-based bargaining. It is a much different bargaining process than we throw our proposals on the table, the state throws their proposals on the table, and you basically argue and fight with one another the whole time you're at the table. Interest-based bargaining is about dealing with problems and solutions. you identify a problem, and you identify your interest on both sides of that problem, and you come up with a solution based on that problem and the interest of that problem. It's much more cordial bargaining. You get to the root of the issues, and we put together, as part of that interest-based bargaining, what we call ground rules. And part of our ground rules complies with 192.660, which allows the public to come in if they so desire to come in.
So just to clarify, if your side or the executive side wanted the public to come in, they would simply not agree to the closed door part of the negotiating, is that correct? Is there an option there?
Madam Chair, that's correct. If we were just going to executive session, and I don't know, I guess in the bargaining world, you might call executive sessions like caucus sessions, where one side or the other decides that they want to caucus on a particular issue. We've never called an executive session in the years that I've been doing this. We do caucus, but not executive sessions.
Questions? Representative Byrne.
Jim, do you vote in those caucuses? Do you approve a contract in those caucuses?
Madam Chair, Representative Grodd, no, we do not. They are strictly for a proposal will be put on the table and you're working through a problem, and one side or the other decides that they don't want to continue their discussions in open on that particular issue. They may want to discuss them in private on that issue and then come back to the table and start discussing again. So, no, there's never any voting that goes on either side. And in our case, because we're a non-strike unit, we have binding arbitration that we rely upon anyway if we can't come to an agreement between ourselves and the state.
Follow up. Jim, in your last contractual meeting, where actually a contract was approved, was there any member of the public present?
Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, no, there was not.
Thank you. Question. Representative Gallegos.
Well, just to follow up to Representative Gerard's question, would they have been allowed to attend? Any member of the public, had they known about it and been willing to come? Would they have been welcome to attend?
For our ground rules, they would have been welcome to attend. And our website has all of our bargaining days posted on our website.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll call Tricia Smith, Merlene Martin, Victor Musial. Musial. Welcome. OSDA.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, a public sector union of nearly 20,000 classified and certified public employees working in Oregon's K-12, Head Start, Community College, throughout the state. And we are here in opposition to House Bill 2762. I'd like to interject before I begin on the bill to say that we in some ways are pleased that House Bill 2762 is before your committee, Madam Chair, because today is the day that my members come to the Capitol to learn about how this process works and to talk to all of you about the things that are going on for them in their schools and their lives. And so this gives them an opportunity to see a committee take up a piece of legislation and see how it would work out there in the world. And so they get to see what you're doing on issues that truly affect them in a way that is personal and upfront. So in that way, I appreciate that House Bill 2762 is before you today. And unfortunately, that is about the only reason I think it should be before you. I have at my right Merlene Martin, who is the president of Oregon School Employees Association, and at my left is Victor Musial, who is the director of field operations and organizing for OSEA. And I brought Merlene up so that you could get a good look at her, and she's available to you if you have any questions, but she asked me to please not make her testify since she hadn't prepared. Mr. Musial will tell you about the finer points of the bill and how they relate directly to bargaining for school district employees and community college classified, and why the pieces, the specifics in the bill won't work, in our opinion, for our members. I would just like to say that I appreciate Representative Gallego's question about closed caucus meetings, because as I read this bill, that's what I thought about, was the deliberation and what I've read about in the press about the controversy about closed caucus meetings in this building, and how the members of the press think it's a good idea that they come into your caucus meetings and watch you talk about issues and sort out the things that need to be sorted out in those kinds of discussions. Caucus meetings are very much like the negotiations in that there are no decisions made in caucus meetings. There are no decisions made in negotiations. The sides come to agreement between negotiators, and that is all. The decisions are made by the public body in public session when they vote to accept a contract, and by the union members when they vote to accept a contract. It doesn't happen in the negotiation sessions, just like with caucus meetings. With that, I will turn the microphone over to Mr. Musial, and he can tell you the finer points of the bill.
Good morning. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Victor Musial, again, Director of Field Operations with Oregon School Employees Association. I wasn't afforded the opportunity to prepare quite as much as President Martin. But let me just get on to some of the points that, that caused me some concern with this bill. Specifically, when we get down to Section 3, Subsection 3, requiring that bargaining can't be held in a place that restricts its membership, such as a union headquarters office. That would preclude us from conducting bargaining at our own offices with an employer. That's not to say that it happens frequently, but it could from time to time, as you know, you change venues and locations, what's convenient. I mean, collective bargaining is quite often done as a matter of convenience, the meeting places and things like that. That's the first problem I have with it. In Section 4, we have a problem with notice, I think, and there's an additional cost to inform the public of when all the bargaining is going to happen, and have the news media in attendance as well. The next Section 2 requires the taking of minutes. Now, this causes me particular concern because these minutes could be construed conceivably as an accurate record of the collective bargaining that took place, especially if there was no formal transcript made by a court, you know, court reporter. And then we have a problem later on of if there is a dispute regarding the application of the negotiated agreement, and it goes before an arbitrator, it goes before the Employment Relations Board, what was the party's intent? Are the minutes that were taken now considered part of the official record, and does that accurately reflect the intent, even though it was the interpretation of the person who was taking the minutes, which would most likely be the executive secretary of the public employer's body? And then moving on to the collective bargaining piece itself and the overly broad definition, I think. This causes me concern in that many times in collective bargaining, we're bargaining already in the sunshine. I don't know if anyone lately that's bargained behind closed doors. That has to be a bilateral agreement between the parties to shut the doors and do it in closed session. And most employers and most public sector unions just aren't willing to do that nowadays. And that's already provided for. But what causes me concern here is quite often in bargaining, especially as you're reaching the final stages of bargaining and it's getting down to the nitty-gritty, you quite often will have sidebars between the two chief spokespersons away from their parties. Would this require that the news media be allowed to attend those sidebars? Because those are very important pieces in terms of getting a settlement where the two spokespersons can speak frankly to each other away from their committees and try and figure out where they can get a deal. What's going to happen with those sidebars? That to me seems problematic. And then the last piece that to me is probably most onerous is in Section 9.3 that allows the commission to impose civil penalties not to exceed $1,000 for a violation. But they may not impose a civil penalty to the public employer if they were acting under the advice of their chief counsel. Well, what happens if the public employees union was acting under the advice of its counsel? They still get hit with a penalty up to $1,000. It's not fair. It's not fair at all. So for these reasons, we are opposed to this bill as it's proposed, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shoffman.
It's not a comment. It's not a question, sir. Thank you for coming. It's a comment. You know, the more I hear, the more I listen, no one lobbied me on this bill, which I'm kind of surprised they didn't, and the first time I read it was this morning. One thing that really, why just collective bargaining? Why not the purchase of property? Why not the evaluation of employees that aren't on their union contract? Why just this? I want someone to answer me, why just collective bargaining?
Representative Shoffler, I believe Representative Cruz made it clear that because it's the expenditure of public funds in budgets, that was his comment.
Madam Chair, with respect, all right, but I'm not satisfied with that. Thank you.
Well, I want to make it clear to the committee that the purpose of these hearings is to ask these questions and to give people an opportunity to give input, and we are not going to work session on this bill, so this is informational, and I appreciate the testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll call. I'm sorry, would you take Representative Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Victor, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about your experience in bargaining contracts, and specifically taking away the ability for what you refer to as sidebars. I mean, I know a little bit, but I don't think as much as you probably do about how that process works. But do you think that would prolong these negotiations or make it more difficult to achieve a settlement if the parties didn't have the ability to, you know, step into another room and talk frankly about what it would take to get a settlement? How do you think that might impact?
Yes. Well, Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, the potential effect could be devastating in terms of being able to reach agreement and having the piece where you can talk in private. In my career in labor, from Florida to Wisconsin to Oregon, I've bargained probably over 200 collective bargaining agreements, and I can't recall very many that I've done where I haven't had to sit with the chief spokesperson for the employer and talk about where we're going, what's the intent, what can we do here, have some sort of sidebar, and be able to do that not only away from the committee but away from everyone else. Now, that's not saying that we're cutting any deals or anything, but trying to get a sense of where we can go with this. So it could be a problem. I mean, if you have news media there covering the whole thing, that's going to definitely flavor or take flavor away, spice, if you will, from the conversations that you're going to have. You're not going to be as candid, and it's going to definitely prolong the process because you're not only playing to your position and your opponent in bargaining, but you're having to have the eyes of the public on you and wonder how that position is played out across the airwaves. And it could be quite problematic.
Victor, once the agreement is reached, before you vote, is there any time period where it goes to the public and they have the opportunity to look at what's been agreed upon and give any input?
Well, typically there's and most employers will do it differently. For the labor organization, the tentative agreement is distributed to its membership, usually in advance, and then a question and answer period is held with that membership to go over that. For the public employer's part, typically that tentative agreement is deliberated in an open session, questions are asked, and it's approved in open session by that public employer.
Would you think it would be a good idea or a bad idea for once the agreement's reached that agreement went to the news media before a vote?
Well, I'm not a big fan of bargaining in the media. That's trying to, gain a one-upsmanship by using the news media to make your position and to gain support like that. I mean, certainly I think it's a public document, and they would have a right to have that if they requested it. But to have it given to them automatically, I don't know that I would want to do that.
I guess what I meant was not just in the news media, but a public forum, whether it be the internet or. So that the public at least see what has happened.
Yeah.
Merlene Martin, OSCA State President. Chair Close, I find it interesting because of the fact that in Cottage Grove we have had open bargaining for, seems like, forever. We have the meetings. It doesn't matter if they're in the afternoon. Doesn't matter if they're in the evening. The public doesn't come. They've had the opportunity for some time. The public doesn't come. Occasionally, the certified staff or union will send one person just to see where we are, and we may go to the certified open bargaining. But the opportunity has been there for considerable time, and the public has not used that at all in order to find out what's going on with their public funds. I don't think I answered your question, and I apologize. Could you say it again?
Well, I was wondering, once you've had the negotiations in private, if you came to a point where there's a period of time before the vote that it became public information so that people could give input before the vote.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't go to the public except for through our media, who will say that negotiations were done, and they often, what we do in our chapter is we, along with the school district, come up with a media release together to make sure it's accurate so that we're not debating what we're saying, and we put something in the paper of where we are at that time. Do we, have a send out minutes to everybody in the community? No, that they are aware of what is going on. And it also, in a small town like where I live, the newspaper comes out once a week, and so it also depends on where it happens. So I have to say, the only way that the media or that the public knows is if they're interested in knowing, and then they have every opportunity to know what is going on.
Madam Chair, and if I can add to that also, I know you remember that the employers in these situations are all elected officials, and they all hear from their constituents just as you do when they are about to make a decision that the public cares about. And so there is an avenue for public reaction to these negotiations right now, because the one party in the negotiation are the elected body who represent the public in these negotiations. And so there is that opportunity for accessing input prior to the vote in any of those situations.
So let me clarify, Trish. If you reach an agreement on, say, a Wednesday, then can that school board member go to the press, or are they held to secrecy until there's been a vote? That's what.
Well, there's no, Madam Chair, there's no real requirement right now that, unless you establish something in your ground rules at the beginning of bargaining, or come to an agreement during the course of bargaining. Typically, when I've bargained a contract, I've liked to hold both sides that there will be no public comment or no media comments except jointly during the course of bargaining. Again, to avoid the appearance of trying to gain one-upsmanship and bargaining through the media when actually we have a public employer to bargain with, not the public. I think the real issue is that we're out there bargaining in the media, requiring the media to come in, almost, and
it's not going to facilitate a good, open, honest discussion and a good conduct of bargaining. I guess one concern I have is I know that there's been several high-profile bargains in the state recently. And of course, when I first saw this, my initial reaction was, geez, is this a knee-jerk to some of that? And if the news media had been allowed in some of those sidebars or caucuses, that could have been a circus, a real Donnybrook there. So.
Hey, Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Under 192.660, it notes that representatives of the news media shall be allowed to attend executive sessions other than those held under subsection 1D, which pertains to public bodies meeting with people who are representing them, not to labor negotiations. So I'm wondering right now if the media said we'd like to come and sit in on this executive session, wouldn't they be allowed to do so?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, that's certainly possible. That would be allowed to happen already. But I haven't had, negotiations, they could, certainly. In terms of if both parties agreed to have an executive session, that, I guess, would be up to, a matter of interpretation at that point. The other thing that in there, it says, they struck in the section of relating to labor negotiations or executive sessions. So, yeah, that would, I mean, this would, currently, they would take that out. It's not available. But under this amendment, it would require that. But then it goes on to say that can require that some of that information not be disclosed. And so I'm wondering how you do that. I mean, Mr. Reporter, here's what's going on, but don't tell anybody.
Representative Gallegos.
Can I just follow up there for a moment, Madam Chair?
Quickly, please.
Well, it is very curious because it does close it by saying that the topic can be undisclosed, even though the media has been invited in.
Mm-hmm.
But just following this in subsection 5, no executive session may be held for the purpose of taking any final action or making any final decision, which makes it sound like very similar in a way to the sort of leadership negotiations that occur in this building.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, my question has to do with them comparing ORS 192.660. Clearly, I have not read it all. It's just what I could glance here. The things that you state about the bill are inconveniences, meeting space, meeting minutes, notification, and many of the elements that are in 2762 are already contained in law. So outside of the convenience issues, I don't quite understand if the law already allows for it, what's the problem with putting it? I mean, the law already allows for the open meetings, so what's the? So why not mandate it then? Because clearly it's there. Why not?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, the problem with it is in the mandating of it. I have engaged in collective bargaining in this state and others where we've sort of modified the bargaining and who's allowed, specifically to limited to members of the labor union, of the collective bargaining agent. So to require that the media be allowed to come in there, especially when we know that they don't always get it right all the time, and they're not experts. There are many fine points in labor law that, unless you're practicing in it and have some familiarity with it, you're not going to know what's going on, and just report what you hear could be misleading to the public. And in regards to the taking of minutes, again, as I pointed out earlier, that could be very problematic, especially as... in almost every case, I mean, there's some litigation that's going to come out of some collective bargaining agreement somewhere, and it's going to
fall back on what was the intent of the parties at the time when they bargained the contract. If you're taking minutes of a bargaining session, and under this could be construed as a record, an official record of that bargaining session, well, then what we have is that a secretary or someone else's interpretation of what was said at the bargaining could be, you know, interpreted as one person's intent when that wasn't necessarily their intent, or they weren't clear at the table.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up. We have that happen all the time here, too. but this is, you know, this looks like the burden's on the public body and not on the union organization.
Right.
But you as the unions have a problem with the public body being required to do these things because of the inconvenience to the public body having to take minutes, or
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, we have a concern about this on for two main reasons. And one is that it eliminates the flexibility in those rare occasions. And before the hearing, I asked Victor if he could remember a situation at OSEA. We have nearly 150 contracts we bargain, and we're in bargaining constantly at OSEA. And I asked him if he could remember a situation where in the last year or so when any of those contracts were bargained in closed-door sessions, and he could not remember any opportunity when that had happened. Our concern is taking away the opportunity for that if the situation calls for it, and if the two parties, and remember the law requires that both parties have to agree to close the door before it can be closed. And so both parties have to recognize some unique and significant situation that would be occurring in their world that they both believe requires that closed door. I think there are other people signed up today who have more experience in this area in recent past than we do, who could perhaps give you some of their reasons why that situation occurred. The other concern we have is the expense. The more a public body pays for the kinds of requirements that exist in 2762, from making sure that an interpreter is there to making sure that notice is given, notice to whom? Notice to everyone in the school district? And how would that notice be provided? It all costs money, and all the money that they spend on those kinds of requirements for a public that seemingly is not interested in this because they could come now and they don't, we think is a waste of money, and believe you me, we do not believe there is one nickel in schools that we can afford to waste right now.
Representative Girard.
First, a quick comment, then a question, if I may. Mr. Musial, to avoid the third-party prejudice you talk about in the minutes, couldn't you simply tape record the meeting?
Madam Chair, Representative Girard, well, yes, you could, and a more accurate way would be to go ahead and engage the services of a court reporter, have those recorded and transcribed as well. But there again, that's a very big expense. And then quite often,
just to put a tape recorder down on a table and record it over tape.
Correct. But then, I mean, you'll have to make sure that each party has a copy, a true and correct copy of the tape, that it is certified. Is there going to be a transcription of that tape? Who's going to be the custodian of that tape? Sometimes that happens already. But like I said, when you get into the finer points of subsequent litigation over a collective bargaining agreement, it can be quite problematic and quite costly in terms of now hiring someone to transcribe that tape, making sure it's an accurate copy, and all those things. And additionally, even if you just have the secretary there taking minutes, I mean, again, there's an extra added expense. That's an added salary. Most times, you don't have that. Each party is responsible for taking their own notes and making sure they get clarification of what's going on at the hearing. And usually, those are relied upon in subsequent venues in arbitrations or unfair labor practice complaints to rely on what our intent was and what we understood and believed the intent of the other party to be during the process that reached agreement.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to go to the next panel in the interest of time. But, committee, if you have further questions, please contact our panelists and discuss it with them. Thank you. I'm going to call Mary Bodkin and Trish Bozeman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tricia Bozak, representing the Oregon Education Association. We represent 45,000 teachers, classified members, and community college members throughout the state. We, too, are here in opposition to House Bill 2762, not because we oppose open bargaining. We do this all the time. I think you saw a recent, very celebrated example of that, the televised bargaining sessions that went on in Portland through the duration of that contract negotiation. But we feel like the changes proposed by House Bill 2762 are in some cases impractical and could be unnecessarily cumbersome. Section 3, I think some of the previous speakers have already talked about the overly prescriptive nature of some of the provisions there about where the meetings can be held, the telephone access, securing an interpreter, I would say. And some of the small districts where we bargain, this could be difficult, if not impossible, sometimes to achieve. Section 6, I think, is the real concern. The definitions we feel like are overly broad and would require some unrealistic posting and notice requirements. And also some of the nature of these would hinder, we feel like hinder the process and what it's ultimately after, and that's a settlement. If you look at one sub A, the collective bargaining, how it's defined as a meeting between a representative of one side and a representative of another, we are, too, as the previous speakers, have concerns about how that would affect sidebar discussions. That's where sometimes the logjam gets broken in negotiations. Those discussions help move the process along. We think that 2762, however, would probably apply to those and probably hinder getting agreement. Obviously, all these things are subject to penalties, and I think that's problematic. Sometimes closed-door discussions are necessary as I said, break the logjam sometimes to get the process moving. Sometimes, too, confidential personnel matters will have given risen to issues at the table. They're not appropriately discussed in public, and they need the latitude to be able to close those discussions off if they need to. We also question whether these provisions would apply to mediation and also the caucus situation that's been discussed already. I think in all that it would and could help inhibit discussion when a free flow of ideas and discussion is needed. And sub B, the conferring about interpretations and applications of the collective bargaining agreement. These are routine and I would say happen daily in school districts across the state. There's no way to anticipate everything that's going to come up, but I think these kinds of discussions are really the essence of the beginnings of grievance hearings, and we settle the vast majority of those early and without much to do about those. We would question whether that would help that if there were posting and notice requirements. It almost seems ludicrous. For example, having a meeting with a personnel director to talk about the interpretation of the contract or whether an employee could take a half day of sick leave versus a full day of sick leave. We feel like that could be subject to these posting and notice requirements. Again, really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And finally, sub C, the execution of written agreements reached in negotiations. We question, too, whether this would apply to memoranda of understanding on smaller matters within the contract that are executed later. Again, the posting and notice requirements would seem a little much in those situations. Finally, I would just say that I think it was in the 1997 session, the law at that time was that all sessions were closed unless the parties requested them to be open. A bill by Representative Markham at that time just kind of flipped the tables on that and said, as the law is now, they're all open unless both parties request that they be closed. We see this as working well in school districts throughout the state now and don't see any need for the changes proposed in 2762. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I guess I just had one question, Tricia. In mm-hmm. Section 4, subsection 1, it says public notice of the time and place for collective bargaining. It seems to be spelled out there that this just is just required for the collective bargaining, not for the grievance process?
We would hope so, but I think when you start to look at Section 6 and is talking about conferring an interpretation of those collective bargaining agreements, I would hope that that would be the case because there are many of those meetings that, that take place daily, on a daily basis. Okay. Discussions. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Bodkin. I'm here this morning representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I'm not going to repeat everything everybody else said. You know, we're going to kind of do a me too on what they've said, but I want to take the committee in a little bit different direction. I want to challenge you a little bit about kind of what is the role of government, and is it to, you know, manage the minutiae of bargaining and public that doesn't come. I mean, nobody cares if they come. They just don't. Because bargaining's boring. It's not very fun. And, you know, for 10 minutes of excitement, you have, you know, a bazillion hours of boredom. But I think that there's another area that we haven't talked about, and Mr. Botwin has kind of touched on a little bit. Most of us in local and state government are now participating actively in interest-based bargaining. And interest-based bargaining is kind of an ongoing process. It doesn't have a, quote, culmination date. There's a contract at some point, but a lot of the issues are ongoing. And, you know, anybody's welcome. Anybody's welcome anytime. And these things, our meetings are regularly posted for our members to participate. Our websites are not secure websites. Anybody can go to them. Anybody can look up the hearing dates. Anybody can look up meeting dates, and anybody can attend.
Mary, but that does not apply to the executive meetings, does it?
We don't have executive sessions except for caucus meetings.
Okay, but Representative Cruz said that when there's going to be a contract decision, that that's done behind closed doors.
No.
That's not correct.
No. With all due respect, Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, in my experience, might be mistaken on that issue.
Well, and I think he's maybe using the broader atmosphere of not just school employees.
He may be looking at private sector, and I have to be honest with you, Madam Chair, I've never bargained in the private sector, so I don't know how they function. You know, I just don't know.
Well, Representative Gerard, since you've been a county commissioner, could you comment?
It's an interesting question, and I believe Ms. Botkin is correct.
Okay.
Madam Chair, may I comment?
Representative Shoffley.
I was on city council for 4 years, and we had executive sessions on occasion. And this whole conversation here this morning seems to be directed at as if these negotiations were strictly held for the benefit of the unions. Well, you know what? When I was on city council, we had a $5 or $6 million budget, and we went into session for the advantage of the taxpayers to get the best deal we could get. I've never been involved in a bargaining process at all. I was in a labor's union, but if I were an employer, which could mean an administrator, a city manager, or a private business owner, I would much rather go off to the side with the union leader and twist their arm without the cameras watching to my advantage. So there's advantages on both sides here. Way it is right now. It's not just for the public employees. It's the advantage for the employer, which is, I would hope, theoretically watching out for the best interest of the people that put them there, and that would be the taxpayer. Thank you,
Madam Chair. I'd like to bring up just one other point. And the final point that we want to bring up is the fact that we bargain for, our union bargains for a variety of public safety entities. You know, in the past, we have not had the need to discuss security issues as it relates to the community in a very demanding manner. Since, you know, it's like, you know, the world changed as we know it on 9/11. And so did the issues that we discuss now between our public safety members and our employers. And I don't know that this has happened, but I can foresee instances where it would be paramount to our ability to be able to hold private discussions to talk about security measures. I can assure you, if we're talking about security measures inside the prison, I don't want the press printing it on the front page of the paper. Now, we have a good relationship with most of the press people that we work with, and we would just simply tell them, you're welcome to sit in, but we better not see this in the paper, because you don't want to compromise the security of your institutions. Or, we represent the Port of Portland Police. I don't want to compromise the security of the airport by having somebody in there that might utilize the information in an untoward manner. And so there are, there are kind of little areas in bargaining that do and don't fit into kind of the public needs to know. And I guess at some level, you have to trust your managers to make good decisions about when the doors ought to be closed. And there are times when the doors may need to be closed, and I think this bill takes away the flexibility of being able to say, this is a time when we need to not have, we don't want people to know what the security procedures at the Bull Run watershed are. Okay? So, there's just new things happening to all of us, and I don't know that we know how it's going to play out yet.
Thank you, Mary. I do believe that, at least in Corvallis and situations where the press was allowed into executive meetings and they were told they could not disclose the information. Representative Kitts.
I'm just getting clarification of what a word meant, so I didn't want to sound like George W. up here for a second. I want to make sure I could say it first. Mary, thank you for your testimony. I want to make sure that I understand, and I'm going to attempt to use this word that I just got clarification on, so if I botch it, please, for the record, forgive me. The existing statutes that are in law now, or are the procedure they're used, if we were to pass something like this, it would really be duplicitous of the existing. Am I correct in your interpretation of, and I'm proud of myself now, just so you know.
Good word.
So, following up with my strategery, I just want to make sure that I'm understanding you guys correctly, that what's trying to be done here, and I wouldn't impugn anybody's motives with any legislation, I think that it's a good government bill is the motives here. Government money, people's money, open laws. But from what I'm understanding, and I want to make sure that I understand you correctly, the existing guidelines for bargaining are covered with what this would aim to do.
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, open bargaining exists already. The law provides for that, yes. I think, as Mary just said, it would eliminate some of the flexibility that's probably necessary. I think she cites some very good examples in the public safety realm where the ability to have some closed-door sessions are necessary. I mentioned a couple of them with confidential personnel matters and those kinds of things that do come up in bargaining from time to time. But I think it, the definitions being overly broad, and I think it overreaches in some ways. I think the current law allows us to do exactly what sounds like you're after.
Madam Chair, follow-up?
Follow-up.
I would just like to state for the record that I worked for George W., so I can say that, but my friends on the other side, those are fighting words.
Thank you, Representative Kitts. Well, thank you, panel. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gerard has a quick question.
One more quick one, and it's more or less a comment. But, Mary, I think you touched something that really is at the heart of this entire discussion. That is trust, in that I think many people today have lost their trust in publicly elected officials, and that's why this is a great discussion to have.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, I know that you have a good relationship with our folks in your district, and, I just... I just know that Janelle Bobbert would never keep you out of a bargaining session if you wanted to be there.
And that's on the record. Thank you very much, panel. And I'm going to call John Marshall, our last witness on this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. Just a few comments about House Bill 2762 and a couple of concerns. Many of those have been expressed by the previous witnesses, but I believe that the definitions of collective bargaining in the bill are way too broad. I refer specifically to Section 6 on page 2, where a definition of a collective bargaining includes to negotiate mandatory subject to bargaining. School districts and their unions also discuss permissive subjects of bargaining. Does this language preclude those particular discussions? Subsection B talks about conferring about the interpretation or application of collective bargaining agreement. Does that include any kind of discussion about how a collective bargaining agreement might be applied after it's already agreed to and ratified? I think those definitions are way too broad. If you'll look at page 4, starting on line 3, labor negotiations shall be conducted open meetings unless both sides of the negotiators request that negotiations be conducted in executive sessions. Those are the current limitations on collective bargaining in open meetings. If you wish to proceed with the intent of this bill, it would seem to me that you merely modify that section and not get into definitions that may not be clear. In addition, a couple other concerns regarding the notice requirements. Oftentimes, particularly towards the end of negotiations when you're near impasse or perhaps even facing a strike deadline, negotiations go into the wee hours. A negotiation session may be adjourned, and then negotiators may want to get some rest and come back in a couple hours. Does this mean that we have to give notice for each of those subsequent sessions? I think that's very confusing. When negotiations begin, both sides get together and adopt what are called ground rules. And these are agreements between both sides that lay out the time and place of negotiations, who's going to be on the negotiating team for the union, who's going to be on the negotiating team for the school district. It's at that time where an agreement can be reached regarding whether or not the negotiations are going to be in open meetings or closed. It's possible that some of the negotiation sessions may be in open, others, both sides would agree, would be closed. For example, the union brings its initial recommendations for a contract to the school district negotiating team. It's conceivable that those ground rules could say, we're going to have that part in open. We're going to have certain pieces of the negotiations from that point in open, or we're going to decide to have it closed. The point I want to make is that there's a great deal of flexibility on the part of both the unions and the school district to make those determinations without all the constraints that we believe that this bill proposes. The notice requirements, as I suggested, are unworkable because of the spur-of-the-moment kinds of negotiations that might come about. The collective bargaining is a very tenuous and delicate circumstance. There's a lot of deal making, there's a lot of give and take, there's a lot of proposals and counter proposals, and while we agree that we are in fact spending the public's funds, and for school districts probably 85% to 90% of our budgets go for personnel costs, and of that amount probably 95% or more are allocated through the collective bargaining process. There are a lot of changes that we'd like to see made to the collective bargaining law, and if you want to get into that, you think the room was full this morning, I can guarantee you that the room would be packed given some of the changes that we'd like to make. I don't think that this bill necessarily accomplishes its goal. As I said, the whole issue of open and closed sessions for collective bargaining have been changed. The last significant change was in Senate Bill 750, and I believe that was enacted in 1997, when it was agreed that these meetings will be open unless both sides agree. And as a practical matter, I think that works well. Again, if you're going to proceed with this bill to mandate that these collective bargaining sessions be open, then we think you could do it in a lot simpler way without creating a number of unintended consequences relative to definitions, time constraints, and so forth that we see in some of the amendments proposed by House Bill 2762.
Thank you, John. I just had a couple things come to mind as you were talking. You know, you talked about the deal-making and the spur-of-the-moment postings. We here at the legislature, as you know, are required to transcribe, we're required to record, we're required to have 20-hour notice posted, and then when we go into the end of session, we have one-hour notice posted. And I think what Representative Cruz is thinking about is these are the rules that we have to operate under, but collective bargaining doesn't. And so I think his intent is, you know, that it should match what the legislature does. So I guess I'm wondering, you know, why, I do know it's spur of the moment, as you said, but we also have to operate that way. So tell me your idea why collective bargaining shouldn't match the legislative process.
If posting means we simply posted a notice of the next collective bargaining session on the school district administrative office bulletin board, that's one thing. And as you know, here in the Capitol, those postings show up outside hearing rooms. If that's the case, and we're required to have those meetings in open, that's one thing. But oftentimes, when we have regular meetings, we have to give notice to the press. Oftentimes, those notices are published in regular school district newsletters, or they're given in advance to the press, particularly in those communities that have weekly or biweekly newspapers. So I'm concerned about the posting requirements. If it's simply a notice, as I said, on the bulletin board, that's one thing. But we're concerned about the other requirements regarding notification of the press in advance and so forth.
I see. That clarifies it. Other questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, certainly the highest profile negotiations lately have been the ones in my community of Portland with the school district. And I know that those did go on mostly in public because they were on cable TV, you know, weekly. But the day that the agreement was achieved that averted a strike that I think nobody wanted, that people were beginning to fear was inevitable, there were a lot of meetings that went on, and certainly representatives of public bodies like the mayor and the county chair were instrumental in those. And I just want to ask you whether you think this bill would impact our ability to achieve those kinds of 11th hour settlements toward strikes, particularly in the climate that we're up against now with these terrible budget.
Representative Rosenbaum, I'm not sure how, if given the fact that those negotiations were, was decided by both parties to make those negotiations open, I'm not sure how the notice requirements for some of those discussions were handled. And I don't know the extent to which the press was notified, for example, we're going to have a meeting in an hour in the mayor's office. I'm not sure exactly how all that works. But it would seem to me that, and I didn't have a chance this morning to check with some of our labor relations folks to figure out exactly how, first, how many school districts actually have their negotiations in open, and second, if they are in fact open, how they handle those notice requirements, and whether or not it's simply notices given to the press or any other interested party that these are ongoing, stay tuned. And at the end of each negotiating session, upon adjournment, we'll give public notice as to when we're going to convene the next meeting. So I'm not sure exactly how all that worked. It would just seem to me that as a practical matter, trying to put all the minutia of notice requirements in the statute is going to be very, very cumbersome, first. Second, if you add to that these requirements for civil penalties, then I think it creates an even more onerous burden. Somebody, the school district, for example, forgets to post that notice. Somebody's upset. They decide to file some kind of suit. because they weren't given adequate notice that the that there was another negotiating session 2 hours or 3 hours later. So I think, again, if the intent is to require all the negotiation sessions to be in open, it could be accomplished very cleanly and very simply by just modifying those existing open meeting law requirements without going through creating all the other pieces that this bill does.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shoffler.
Yeah, you know, I'm amazed that somebody hasn't filed suit saying that we in this building can no longer post an hour before a meeting or hearing. I'm just commenting there. Thank you.
And Representative Shoffler, I would say that that's because the rules that we operate under are passed by the legislative body, and right. So you have the opportunity at that point to speak that forth and to vote against it.
Thank you.
That's why you have to read the rules very carefully.
And I still don't understand them.
I understand. Well, thank you, John. That really clarifies it and wraps it up well.
Madam Chair, if it's your intent to proceed, I'd like to bring you more information about exactly how these negotiation sessions in open actually work.
Okay. So, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. Well, that concludes our witnesses on this bill. I would like to thank everybody who sat through this with us. I think we all learned a great deal, and we appreciate your being here. Closing the House, the hearing on House Bill 2762, and if there's nothing else for the good of the committee, we are adjourned.